Good afternoon. I'm opening this meeting of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on General Government. Today is Tuesday, February 21st. The agenda has two public hearings and two possible work sessions. We are going to begin with opening public hearing on House Bill 4091. We will take some testimony on that. Then we will open the public hearing on Senate Bill 1587, take some testimony on that, and we're going to go back and forth between two because I'm accommodating the needs of legislators that are in the audience with us to provide testimony. So I am opening the public hearing on House Bill 4091 relating to criminal records checks. And Representative Holvey, would you like to testify?
Madam Chair, I apologize for being late, and I would respectfully ask if the chair would indulge it. I've had an intern in my office today, Martin Nelson Harrington, and would you extend the courtesy of allowing him to join us at the dais? He's sitting in the front row right next to
you.
Yes.
He's next to me.
That's, okay. That's great. We don't have a nameplate, and we know who it is, though.
Martin, why don't you come up?
There should be a slight additional charge for that, Senator.
I've had my daughter sitting next to me over the past week. So.
You're joining the committee.
Hi, okay. I'm Senator Steinberg. Hello. Welcome.
Representative Holvey, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chairs and committee members. Really appreciate the opportunity to speak real briefly on this so you can get on with your agenda so I can get back to the Rules Committee. I just did want to come and provide just a little bit of background on this effort concerning criminal background checks and our efforts really to find efficiencies. It's become very clear that we have several different agencies that are struggling with the requirements of having background checks and specifically repeated background checks on the same individual time and time again, and within one agency having to do this over and over. Huge, seems like to me anyway, and several others, including Representative Nathanson, who's been working on this, waste of energy, waste of money and resources, not just for state government, but for school districts, local governments, nonprofits, and private business, all of whom have requirements to get background checks. It became clear to us that this is a big issue that really does need a longer effort with stakeholders. We tried to look at basically just allowing the state police to retain fingerprints in an effort to reduce the redundancy. That comes with a whole nother policy discussion around privacy issues. And we felt that we really needed to punt this to a work group to really give it due consideration and involve some more stakeholders in this effort. I think it is something that we really do need to do. I know work groups sometimes cost a little bit of money, but I think the end result of this one will save us in the long run. And with that, I appreciate this opportunity and urge your due consideration of this bill.
Thank you, Representative Holvey. Yes, Senator Johnson.
I would just like to add that I've sat in on some of those meetings under Representative Nathanson's leadership and realized how a common sense notion of having a single ID and a single point to get it and a single charge for it could metastasize into such a snake ball of issues. And this is a place where I think there is genuine savings that could be realized if you had an adequate forum to do the work, and certainly a reduction of cost. I mean, I could lay out a scenario where someone is a home health care worker, they want to volunteer in their child's school, they maybe want to coach some after-school athletics or be a docent at the zoo, and all of a sudden there, and I shouldn't maybe have picked the zoo, I'm seeing Mr. Jordan smiling, that might have been a bad example, but where someone just in the civic life of their community or in their child's life or children's life would have enough ID checks that they could spread them out like playing cards and each one of them costing $35 or $50. So this is a problem that just cries out for some kind of thoughtful solution. Get all the stakeholders together, figure out the privacy issues, and I thank you for bringing the bill to our attention.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And I just would add that, you know, we looked at DHS came forward with, or some advocates came forward with a proposal to get a grant to implement the wrap-back system, which is an incredibly great idea. But unfortunately, it was sort of having the cart before the horse until we settle the policy issues around privacy and protecting those records and having that sort of form. We just couldn't quite get there, and I just felt it appropriate to move this to a work group, and I certainly hope DAS is able to provide the staffing that this bill would require. Thank you very much, and I'm going to jet out. If it pleases the chair.
Yes. Thank you, Representative Holvey. What we're going to do now, there are several other people signed up to testify on this bill. However, we have another legislator with us. So I'm just hang on. Everybody who's here on 4091, we're going to come back to that. I am now opening a public hearing also on Senate Bill 1587, and we're going to have at least one set of people testify. Would LFO like to open this and present some opening remarks on this one bill?
Chair Nathanson, member of the committee. Senate Bill 1587 comes to you from the Senate Committee on General Government, Consumer, and Small Business Protection. The original bill terminates the semi-independent status of the Appraiser Certification and Licensure Board and makes it a state agency again. And you have in your packet a dash one, which replaces the bill, and this requires the Appraiser Certification and Licensure Board to report to Legislative Assembly regarding, one, the board's procedures for dispute resolutions, the board's procedures relating to conflicts of interest among board members, and the current process by which a person becomes an appraiser. And the dash one has no revenue impact and minimal fiscal impact.
Thank you. Senator Winters, thank you for joining us. I have a note that Kathy Goss and is it Fred Panetta would be joining you for this first panel.
Yes, and thank you, Co-Chair Nathanson and Co-Chair Johnson and Co-Chair Garrard and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Jackie Winters, a state senator representing District 10, and I want to thank you for hearing Senate Bill 1587 with the dash one amendments. And let me explain it so for the audience, because I think there are those that might be listening. The bill does not, with the dash one amendment, eliminate the semi-independent status of the board. What the bill does, it requires the board to report to the legislature, Legislative Assembly by May 2013. Just a little background, and the reason I asked for particularly Fred Panetta to join me here, Mr. Panetta was the individual who several years ago provided the work in this building and helped to pass the original legislation that created the semi-independent status of the board. He's also an individual that I have been working with on this particular issue that brought this to my attention in the first place. I became involved in this issue back in 2009. It was an issue that I identified that there was some conflicts of interest that the board of members on the board. And at that time, after having several meetings both with the executive director and Kafori and others, we agreed that one of the individuals would be removed from the board to eliminate the conflict. Since then, I've done some more work in looking at the board and its culture and climate. And I think that's important. You know, we think in terms of boards and their independence. And what I've, in this particular board, and the reason I'm asking for a report back, and I want to just share with you one comment that I've received. And I'm going to give you this file for the record. And it says, it appears to be a habit of using former ACLB members in a review capacity. In my view, this raises doubt as to their objectivity. In other words, you have someone on the board who's reviewing the work of the other board, of a member of the board. You also have a practice that occurs in the board, and you will hear from one of from Mrs. Goss, where it's cloudy when a person does some work, and then you have somebody else to review that work, and then if there's a conflict, there's another person that reviews the work. And in my work, when I was a state ombudsman, I would have said it's like the fox watching the hen house, and you're gathering all the eggs. And so it caused some question in my mind as to whether or not we should be asking some questions, and we did ask some questions of the Ethics Commission. And as a result of asking the questions of the Ethics Commission, it was determined that perhaps we should pose those questions to the agency and ask them to come back and respond to how they handle, one, resolutions when there is a conflict, and two, how they handle conflicts of interest on their board. And so that we can, as a body, you know, take a look at whether or not there is some legislative remedy that needs to take place. So that's why I'm bringing this before you. We hear from others who have been directly involved. My community brought this to my attention, and I believe that the report is necessary and needed to, if nothing else, but to remove the cloud that's over the operation of the board.
Thank you. Excuse me, Senator Johnson.
I have two questions. The first one is, why do we need a bill to ask this semi-independent agency to clean up its act? I have had numerous constituent contacts, and it appears to me that this board is a mess. And I'm just trying to figure out, why do we need legislation to tell them to report back to the legislation on their manifold conflicts of interest, or the appearance of the manifold conflicts of interest?
Well, Senator Johnson, co-chair Nathanson, it started out when I said, when it was a mess, that I was going to just to eliminate their independent status and put them back under an agency status, which then we would have review and oversight. After having conversation with both the governor's office and having conversation with some of the members of the board, as well as in talking to Mr. Bennett, for clarity, it was thought that the better approach was to get some answers to the questions that I posed, which that's why I asked for the report.
Okay. Second question, Madam Chair. Mm-hmm. Now I've just closed my little file on them. I can't find them right away, so I'm going to do this by memory. There is another part to the dash ones that – oh, thank you. I just – the other part to the dash ones is Section C that talks about 5 years of experience as a principal real estate broker licensed under ORS 696 in the county in which the person seeks to be a candidate. Can you give any details on, was this a carve-out? Is this some special accommodation? Because this board seems to look at special accommodations from time to time.
I do not believe that is germane to the appraiser board. I believe that is germane to expanding the pool of applicants that can apply for a license. And I had understood that Senator George had called and talked to you about that amendment.
Madam Chair, may I respond to that?
Yes.
He had, but it had to do with county treasurers, county clerks, and expanding the pool of people that could run for office. I don't know what problem statement we're trying to fix in what is already a pretty complicated bill.
I would suggest you talk to Senator George.
Okay.
Ms. Goss.
Thank you very much. Thank you to the co-chairs and the members of the committee. And I thank you for taking the time to listen. My name is Kathy Goss, and I reside at 3422 El Dorado Loop South here in Salem. My husband and I own Capital Valuation Group, and we are both here in support of 1587 as it has been amended. I'm a certified general appraiser for the state of Oregon, and I fall under the jurisdiction of the Appraiser Certification and Licensure Board, which is the ACLB that we've heard of for the state of Oregon. We've been in business in Salem for 15 years and complete an average of 200 commercial appraisals annually, and we've been doing that for 15 years. We have never had a complaint filed against us that resulted in any fine or any penalty. We have trained many, many of Salem's best appraisers who have gone on to establish their own businesses. Unfortunately, my firm has been involved in an administrative complaint since June of 2011. The complaint concerns a very complicated appraisal we wrote in 2008, nearly 4 years ago. The complaint came directly from the ACLB, not from our client or from the property owner. The ACLB investigation contacted two assistant appraisers who work in my office. Both were interviewed, all before I was asked a single question. One assistant was called on the phone by the ACLB investigator asking if she could chat at a local restaurant, and he would not record the interview. She commented that she didn't know him and wasn't comfortable doing that. If they needed an interview, she would go to the office, the ACLB office. He stated she must cooperate with him or she would risk being sanctioned by the ACLB. She finally said she would meet him at the office. He chose their
office. Who is the she? I've kind of lost track of the narrative.
She's an assistant appraiser that works for us. And when the complaint was filed, then the assistants that worked for us were called in, as well as our subcontractor, and eventually my husband and I, for an investigation.
Does the she have a name? I just am trying to...
Sarah Morrow.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Even at the office, he chose not to record her interview. She was asked about her brother, who used to work for us, about our vacations, when, how long, and how many, how she was supervised, and by whom. I believe this interrogation was abusive and punitive and far afield of the complaint. She was not involved with the property involved in the complaint at all. I have printed material of what occurred in that interview. After this experience, I felt compelled to hire an attorney to be present during all interviews of any of our employees to prevent this inappropriate behavior by the staff. The ACLB functions as the complainant, the investigator, the prosecutor, the judge, and the jailer. They have full and complete ability to close the doors of our business and remove our licenses, as well as the income stream and insurance benefits that I supply for my employees. I have not been provided an investigative report, only the verbal warning that further interviews will most likely be necessary. This lengthy investigation has not only provided anxiety to clients and employees, but to myself and my husband. Because of limited time, I'm skipping some of the complications of my case, but the governor has interceded and resolved some conflicts of interest on the board. Again, I think this amended bill will be helpful to the future operation and the transparency of that agency. Thank you.
Thank you, Mrs. Goss. And Mr. Bonetta.
I am Fred Venata, located at 3340 Commercial Street Southeast in Salem. I'm here expressing only my own opinion and not representing any other party. As indicated, I was the one responsible for taking the board from its captive status in the Consumer and Business Service Agency to the semi-independent status. I am a strong supporter of the semi-independent status for these licensed professionals. I think they serve both the licensed professionals and the legislature well because of the things that they do and don't have to do if they're semi-independent. At the same time, I believe there have been some serious problems with this board. And that troubles me. I think these questions are a way to get at some of the issues there and determine if we need some additional regulation for the boards. I'm not saying I'm prepared to suggest we do or we don't, but the questions that are in the amended bill, I think are important, and I would urge you to pass this bill, or if the Ways and Means Committee wants to adopt a resolution and order the board to do it and not pass a bill, that's your decision and certainly not mine. But I think getting at these questions is important for the future of the semi-independent status of the agencies. Thank you. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Van Atten. I apologize for misstating your name. It wasn't on the witness registration form, and I misinterpreted a note that was given to me if I said it wrong the first time.
I thought you said it fine.
Okay, thank you. Just a moment. Well, we're going to take just one or two brief questions for this panel and then move on back to the other bill. Yes. Representative Girard.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Fred, I just want to I'm kind of going to paraphrase what you just stated as best I can. You just assure me that I'm on the right track. You feel the amended version of this bill is the correct bill and that it should be moved out of this committee.
That is correct.
Yes. Thank you very much.
Co-Chair Nathanson, just for the record, I do have that I would like to leave with the clerk some statements from Spencer Powell, who was the past president of the National Appraisal Institute, as well as Catherine Vance, who also, and so I want to leave them because their testimony, I believe, is important. They, too, support the amended version. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We'll make sure the copies are distributed. Thanks for being here. Now we're going to continue with the hearing that we had opened previously. And we have additional witnesses for that. I think what I'd like to do at this time is pass the gavel to my co-chair, Representative Girard, so that I can give some brief testimony from over there to you, and then we'll continue with everybody else.
Okay, so we're reopening the public hearing on 4091, and the chair recognizes Representative Nathanson.
Why, thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, and members of the committee. I'm Nancy Nathanson, Representative, House District 13. We're back to criminal background checks. You've heard some testimony from Representative Holvey about the need for this bill. I want to share with you briefly, I'm interested in this bill, not with the specific policies about when background checks are required and under which circumstances, but in the business of government, and are we doing it in the best way that we can. We should require that they're done in the most efficient and reasonable way possible. In the course of explaining state budget cuts a couple of years ago to constituents, including nonprofit organizations delivering critical services to persons in our community, I invited them to provide suggestions to me how we could do the business of government better and how we could stretch our dollars further. They were appealing, naturally, for more money at the same time that we were trying to explain to them why we were cutting the budgets. And it's one of those heartbreaking situations. They followed up with me, and they did provide several suggestions for how we could stretch dollars, how we could help them spend less delivering services, because in some cases it's the requirements that we and burdens that we place on those agencies or organizations. This problem involves dozens of occupations, over 50 state agencies, and impacts a large number of Oregon businesses and organizations. Some of the materials I received from DAS in their analysis cover state agencies getting background checks on their own employees, but of course we're talking about all the other licensed professions as well. So why are individuals or their employers paying for duplicated background checks? Could this repetitive effort be avoided? Further, we have heard that the wait for results can be as much as 5 or 6 weeks. If that's the case, then we're talking about someone being unemployed for an additional 5 or 6 weeks while they're waiting for this background check, and we're also talking about someone who's waiting to receive the service for 5 to 6 weeks in the case of a home care worker, for example, and we're also talking about an employer being unable to fulfill a contract or provide service to someone that employer is trying to do provide work for. This is not simply fixing one bottleneck in a system because, in fact, we don't have a system. We have over 50 different agencies and boards, for example, doing their own processes, doing their own sets of rules. So I'm hoping that with a work group we can identify some standard components of background checks, design a more standard process to suit the type and level of background check that's really needed, organize the work so that it's more streamlined, but get started now and not just wait for the future. I have received information from a number of different agencies, and you're going to hear from some of them today. But I'll tell you, it's just heartbreaking to hear how many times, as Senator Johnson has said, someone may need to pay for a background check. One of the most egregious examples is a letter of testimony we received. There's a woman who's employed as a teacher in Lane County in an early intervention program beginning in 2007. To make a longer story as short as possible, this person has been providing services for this one particular child as a teacher and also daycare, I believe, for over 4 years. She went through the FBI fingerprint search. She's been through the Child Care Division background registry. The child was also a student in her classroom. She has continued to provide child care to this family for 4.5 years. The child that was originally in her class has now moved on to public elementary school. She got a master's degree, which is a wonderful thing. Her child care registry status was renewed. After she got her degree, she applied to provide behavioral consultation services through the Lane County DD Services Division. She had to go through another background check, more time, more expense, all to provide service to the same child that she has been seeing for 4.5 years. That's the end of my testimony for right now. Thank you.
I can do it later.
Senator Snyder Hayward has a question.
Well, I just want to thank Representative Nathanson and those who are committed to this. I believe that I have been through 3 background checks in the past 6 months, less than 6 months. As some of you know, we became permanent foster parents in January, so I went through a background check with DHS to become a foster parent. And then I went through a background check to be appointed to the seat. And then I went through a background check to become a volunteer at my new foster child school. So if anybody doesn't believe that this is necessary, not to mention when I was a Girl Scout leader for 10 years and those background checks didn't count for anything. So I hope that this work group includes not-for-profit organizations that, as Senator Johnson mentioned, need to conduct these checks as well. And this is a perfect example of the work that you and Mr. Jordan and others are doing to try to consolidate state services and provide centralized services that other people can access, which will be helpful to both the not-for-profit and the state sector. So thank you very much, having been very personally affected by this.
I can see. Thank you for your remarks, and I'm sorry about the story that you had to provide. Shall we proceed with public testimony? Yes, Senator Whitsitt.
I just was curious if there has been any breakthrough on how you would do this without retaining some biological sample, whether it be a fingerprint or whatever. So, you know, has there been any breakthrough on that at all?
You want a response from me or an agency person?
from you.
From what I know, there are certain things about the processes themselves and about administrative rules that can be changed that would help. But yes, we also need to look at being able to retain, either retain records or retain the results of the background check, which is a different thing than retaining a fingerprint itself, for mm-hmm. example. Yes. But that's all what would be discussed by this work group. How can we start addressing those challenges?
Thank you.
Yes. Okay, public testimony. The first witness, let's bring three people up, Josh Graves, Megan Moyer, Andy Smith. And that will be followed by Tim Krall and Tricia Smith. And just be sure to state your name for the record as you begin speaking.
I'm Josh Graves with Catholic Community Services, co-chair Nathanson, Johnson, and Gerard. Thank you for having me here today. I'm the Senior Director of Operations at Catholic Community Services and also representing the Oregon Alliance of Children's Programs today. It was kind of a last-minute invite. About noon, I was asked to come down here today and testify, and I prefer a longer period of time than that, but when I heard what this was about, I thought, now, this is something that's important to me and something I know about. So I appreciate being here today. I am a boots-on-the-ground leader of a 501c3 nonprofit right here in Salem. We provide services to foster children. We provide residential care and care to developmentally disabled adults. Don't take anything in my testimony as trying to criticize the need for criminal history checks. Criminal records checks are extraordinarily important. I've been in the business for 20 years, and unfortunately, I've seen bad things happen in the business. And so I think it is vitally important that we keep a system of some sort in place. Currently in our organization, I did some work on it today, we have four major yet distinct systems for criminal record checks in our organization. And when I say system, I use that somewhat loosely. For our foster care, we provide foster care to the Department of Human Services children under contract. That is one distinct criminal record check. We provide foster care to OYA youth treatment foster care from the Oregon Youth Authority. That is a second distinct check. We now provide, since Senate Bill 991, a couple of sessions ago, we provide care under the Safe Families Program, which is a distinct criminal history check. And then we also provide human resources criminal history checks for our employees. I spoke with our human resources director today, and on the human resources criminal records checks, there are 3 to 5 different systems depending on where that employee works in our organization. So if they work with youth, if they work with developmentally disabled adults, if they do administrative work, there can be 3 to 5 different systems just within that. So at this point, we're looking at between 7 to 8 different criminal records check systems just within our organization. Very briefly, a couple of the major issues with this. We can submit foster parent criminal history checks to both the Oregon Youth Authority and the Department of Human Services. Oftentimes we do that because people want to become foster parents for us. Just a few months ago, it was taking up to 6 months to get a criminal record check back from an Oregon Youth Authority, somebody who wanted to be a foster parent for us serving Oregon Youth Authority children. It's really hard to retain excited foster parents when they're trained, ready to go, and excited, and you're waiting 6 months for a criminal records check. So we submit both to DHS and OYA, which was working pretty well until they told me that that's actually exacerbating the problem because we really need to submit to one or the other and work through the system rather than duplicating systems and backing up the system even further. What's interesting in this is we can submit to both of those systems and get different results for people that are basically doing the same care. So one will respond and say, no, we're going to reject this individual, and the other one says, we'll accept them, which kind of puts us as an organization in a strange place where why would one accept and one not accept? At that point, we tend to not accept the individual because somewhere the other organization believed it was a good background check. The inefficiency to our human resources department in trying to figure out which background check is the most appropriate for employees is very time consuming, and we can actually use multiple systems based on time that are appropriate, legal, and okay to use, but it's just such an inefficient system. We also are tied up to if somebody has lived outside of the state of Oregon for more than 10 years, we have to do a multi-state check, and then we're, from what I understand, at the will of the other states the individuals lived in. That can take months to actually employ an individual who's lived outside of the state of Oregon within 10 years, which doesn't do anything to help our employment in this state. So I really appreciate the opportunity that you're looking at and creating a work group. I appreciate Representative Nathanson's attention to this. It is a system that needs attention. It can be fixed. It will also have a major impact in the lives of children we serve. We have kids. We have had young people on waiting lists for foster homes, for residential treatment foster homes, for months, because we have foster parents who are trained and ready to go, but we haven't got the background checks, and we just can't place them until they've been background checked. So the effect on children is very significant as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Graves. Ms. Moyer.
Chairs Johnson, Nathanson, Garrard, for the record, my name is Megan Moyer. I'm with the Service Employee International Union. We represent 60,000 workers in the state of Oregon, most of which have a background check requirement for employment, many of which go through the background check unit of DHS. We also represent the workers who do the background checks for DHS, as well as several other state agencies and licensing boards. We've been engaged on the issue of duplicate background checks or rechecking issues for several years, and have appreciated the interest by both Senator Johnson and Representative Nathanson over the years on what we could do to streamline and make this system better. And we are strongly supportive of this bill. We are proponents of looking at the wrap-back system that Representative Holvey briefly talked about. It does have some questions about what information would we be retaining, what kind of opt-in or opt-out policy would we want. But when you look at the way criminal background checks are done, it reaches a point where you just want to beat your head against the wall. I'm sure that Catholic Charities experience is no exception. Certainly, we have issues in regards to our CNAs and nursing homes needing their criminal background check to get into a program to get a CNA. It's a different background check to get licensed. And then again, when they were hired by a facility, they have to do a criminal background check. That can be three background checks within a six-month period. None of the results can be shared with each other. They're all independent evaluations, although it's for the same job. So that's one example. Workers who are working in long-term care cannot go from one facility to another without a new background check, because that is Oregon statute. We have no transferability between like settings. So we are very much interested in a conversation about the portability of background checks where appropriate. I mean, I don't think the standards for every setting are equal, and I very much respect the work of the background check unit and DHS's child welfare that does the actual evaluation of the background check. And we don't want to minimize the importance of closely evaluating the appropriateness of individuals in settings, but I think there is a lot of opportunity around where it is the same work or substantially same standards, and we look forward to seeing how we might be able to reduce that and reduce costs for the state.
Thank you for your testimony. We'll now hear from Andy Smith and Tim Kroll. And that will be followed by Tricia Smith.
Oops. Good afternoon, co-chairs Nathanson, co-chair Garrard, and co-chair Johnson, and members of the committee. My name is Andy Smith. I am the legislative liaison for the Association of Oregon Community Mental Health Programs. Our membership is comprised of mental health programs in all Oregon's 36 counties, the mental health organizations, which provide the mental health and behavioral health benefits under the Oregon Health Plan, and we also, membership includes One Tribe. Our association is strongly in favor of this legislation. And to give you some context in the environment where it's involved with community mental health, it might be with peer delivered services, housing context, family support services, so really a number of instances and more than just that. But what we want to emphasize with the bill were some themes that we see prevalent in the conversation that's going on. One would be ease of application, the application process itself, that this is an opportunity to simplify that. Second would be the theme, and this is probably one of the most consistent themes our members talk about, and that's transferability, portability of these records, that there's thought given into that, that particular advantage that can come from this type of work group. Third would be the coordination of limited resources you've been talking about among agencies. You know, and lastly, we do want to make sure that, and I'm sure you will highlight this, but the primary purpose for this is a safety component, both for the individual and the community. So, of course, we want to continue to draw attention to that fundamental goal. So we're very happy to support this legislation. Last session, we worked with Representative Nathanson on another bill that had to do with DHS and administrative burdens, 2856, and she's worked on a number of bills. But we think that this approach towards really advancing better and smarter government is the right way to go, and we're very happy to support this legislation. Thank you.
Mr. Kroll.
Representative Nathanson, co-chairs, members of the committee. My name is Tim Kroll, and I've been executive director of the Oregon Rehabilitation Association for 27 years. I've worked in the field for 37 years. Our association includes nonprofits who deliver homes and jobs to people with disabilities statewide. Riverside in St. Helens, Reach in Klamath Falls, Pearl Buck and Full Access in Eugene, Tualatin Valley Workshop, Abilitree in Bend, Albertina Kerr. Our members serve over 13,000 people with disabilities and employ over 10,000 people. We strongly support this bill. We appreciate your introducing it, Representative Nathanson. I think you and Representative Holvey did a good job, as have others, in describing the impact and why it needs to change. I attached testimony from Jan Aho, Executive Director of the Pearl Buck Center, who also reflects the opinions of all of our membership. And I want to point out that the entire disability community, the developmental disability community, the DD Coalition, Families Advocates, the Mental Health Directors Association, County DD Program Directors, the Oregon Support Services Brokerages, and the DD Council support this bill. One thing I'd like to add, DHS and OHA do have a project called CRIMS, C-R-I-M-S, Criminal Records Information Management System, which will address some of these issues, but not as broadly as the bill you've introduced. So we don't think that replaces. I think the objectives of the bill go beyond the CRIMS system within DHS, and we hope that it comes to be a reality. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Tricia Smith. And is there anyone else in the audience who was planning to testify on House Bill 4091? Why don't you come forward now? Thank you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, and Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Tricia Smith. I apologize for my voice today. I represent Oregon School Employees Association, 20,000 classified and certified employees working in Oregon's early childhood K-12 and community college systems. I believe our members may have been the first public employees that were subjected to criminal background checks. I was trying to remember if we were the first. If we weren't, we were very close to the first. And so this has been an issue for us for a couple of decades now. We appreciate and support House Bill 4091. As we have watched the number and scope of employees and others that are background checked, we have also watched as we created the more than 50 systems to accomplish that. Some of our members work for two employers as a part-time employee. They are required to be background checked by both of those employers. We look forward to seeing whether or not this process can be streamlined for our employers and for our members, while at the same time protecting the privacy rights of our members as you go through this process. So thank you very much for the bill, and we look forward to the work in the interim.
Thank you for your testimony. And the final piece of testimony on this bill.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Grover Simmons. I represent the Independent Adult Foster Home Association and have been involved with adult foster homes for about 27 years. And I'm trying to retire and move this account over to another person. But I would like to go on the record that the industry supports criminal background checks. So we favor what you're going to accomplish. We strongly support it, as a matter of fact. But just to add some concrete examples as to what you've heard already today, you'll take a prospective employee. Employer is interviewing this person, and then if there is a long wait for that criminal background record to be cleared, that prospective employee is going to go down the street and go to work for somebody else. And so many, many, many times I've had calls from adult foster home operators that they have just lost a good possible employee because of the delay in getting the report back. Secondly, if you have an adult foster home and you have a caregiver working in that home, and the person does a good job and they're promoted to resident manager, it requires a second background check. So what you have is the same house, the same employer, and the same residence, and a second background check is required when that resident, when that worker is promoted to resident manager. And as Senator Johnson says, what's needed is just some common sense. It's indefensible what goes on in this industry with respect to criminal background checks. You take two different counties, Multnomah County and Clackamas County. Whenever you're cleared in one county, you cannot take that clearance and go to work in a second county. If it happens to be right across the street and you're at the county line, it doesn't make any difference. Last example, a homeowner of an adult foster home, beautiful home, had a second home right next door, almost identical buildings, and not more than 100 feet away. She wanted to open a second home. Second criminal background check. I mean, it's the word ludicrous comes to mind. And that's been my experience in this industry with this subject over many, many, many years. So we support your work. I served on the committee that looked into this subject that the governor helped appoint, and we wish this new committee good luck. Thank you.
Thank you for the testimony. And that was the last person I had recognized that is here to testify on that bill. Is that correct? I want to make sure that there's no one else before I close the public hearing on House Bill 4091. Gone. I'm closing the public hearing now. And we're going to take a recess for about 30 seconds, just for me to make sure that the committee understands the process. We're out of recess now. I am now opening a work session on House Bill 4091 relating to criminal records checks. Mr. Stainer, could you please give us a brief comment from LFO?
Certainly, Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee. Just a couple notes about this bill. There's no revenue impact for the bill, but there is a fiscal impact. That fiscal impact is resultant from the assumed costs that will incur at the Department of Administrative Services. The bill has a fairly short timeline. It's about 8 months. This work group has to be convened, and then a report given to the appropriate interim committee of the legislature. And the Department of Administrative Services does not feel that they have adequate staff to get it done with in that short period of time with the people they have. They'd like to have a limited duration position for 9 months. That would include the time to get the work group convened, do the work, and then report to the legislature, and then have about a month period to deal with questions and so forth and so on. The total cost of that position and estimated legal costs are just roughly $102,000.
At this time, I would like to ask someone from Department of Administrative Services, either Mr. Jordan or someone else, to come tell us about, is this really about hiring new staff or reassigning existing staff, and whether the department anticipates that over all the departments or agencies of state government, that we would realize savings that exceed the cost of this particular work.
Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Michael Jordan. I'm the Chief Operating Officer for the state and the Director of the Department of Administrative Services. To your question and potentially to the fiscal, the fiscal was put there because this isn't free. You can't do this kind of work for nothing. Now, having said that, the department fully believes it's work that should be done. I have absolutely no substantive disagreements with anything you've heard today in public testimony or with the fact that the system that we have, if you can call it that, is unbelievably cumbersome and redundant. And I have intuitive confidence that there would be much greater savings than the cost that we would incur in doing the work that the bill asks us to do. Having said all of that, Madam Chair, these things don't happen for nothing. So, and there will be some costs regarding the legal analysis from Department of Justice. So I believe that's some component, although a small component of the fiscal.
Thank you.
You bet.
Senator Johnson.
Mr. Jordan, this was a happy committee right up until the fiscal, and I think there was a certain amount of sort of slack-jawed amazement. I mean, I know nothing happens for free, but this committee has had the opportunity to comb through your budget. You are a multi-million dollar agency, and I guess what some of us need is a little reassurance that there is not somebody in that huge bureaucracy at DAS that would be capable of performing this work. I understand that when you solicit DOJ opinions, just like if I go to my lawyer, I'm going to get a bill. I understand that piece of it. But there's not somebody in that huge agency of however many hundred employees you have that could be reassigned to do this work without the additional fiscal?
Chair Nathanson, Senator Johnson, of course. Of course there is.
Okay, then that begs the question of how come we have a $100,000 fiscal in front of us if you broke out the legal piece of it. I am asking LFO, how much does it drop if you take out the LD, limited duration, excuse me for using an acronym, and you just look to the costs of engaging the Department of Justice?
Madam Chair, Senator Johnson, the Department of Administrative Services estimated the legal costs to be just about $17,000.
Senator Whitsitt, then Senator Steiner Hayward.
I've been doodling here, Mr. Jordan. That's a 9-month duration position. taking off the $17,000 for the Department of Justice is a $118,000 a year position.
Madam Co-Chair, Senator Whitsitt, I didn't do the calculation on the fully loaded costs of
the
limited
position.
No, what I meant was I didn't do the calculations of what the full loading of the cost would be. That's a fully loaded cost, I'm sure, not just salaries.
What's the difference?
Other benefits.
No, I know what the difference is. I was being facetious, but I mean that the cost to the public is the same.
That's correct, Senator.
I don't think we can separate, Mr. Jordan, the cost of benefits and the cost of salary. It's all one thing.
Co-Chair Nathanson, Senator Whitsitt, you're correct. It's all one thing.
Senator Steiner Hayward.
Two questions. One, I guess, partly for LFO to put you on the spot, and one for Mr. Jordan. Mr. Jordan, if you did reassign somebody, what would that person not be doing?
Co-Chair Nathanson, Senator Steiner Hayward, I couldn't tell you today what they would not be doing because I don't know who would get reassigned. So it's very difficult to tell you. But given the type of work, they'd either be someone who does what I would consider relatively political level project management.
Okay.
So you're not talking about somebody who's going to be constructing a building. You're talking about somebody who manages a project that will have sensitive implications, political issues involved, and certainly multiple interests in the issue, along with multiple agencies. So someone who would do that kind of project management, it would be the kind of person we'd try to assign to it.
And then the question, if I may, Madam Chair, the question for LFO and perhaps for Mr. Jordan as well is, do we have any sense of what the cost is currently to state agencies for doing all these background checks? And if we don't or do we have any sense of what the potential savings might be if we were able to work out a system that would get rid of this duplication of services and work? Not to put you on the spot.
Madam
you can
Chair,
tell me you don't know.
Senator Steiner Hayward, well, I am going to tell you I don't know, but let me qualify that a little bit. The first part of your question, do we know what it costs to do all of these background checks? I'm sure that could be assembled. And then the second part of your question, what would we save? This is in compiling the fiscal analysis for this bill, one of the things that we did not look at was what are the possible savings, what are the possible ongoing, what happens at the end of the work group, because that's really not the subject of the bill. The subject of the bill is to convene the work group and to conduct the work group and provide a report. And so this cost is simply for that. And it's exclusive of any kind of savings or any kind of idea of what it costs currently to do these.
Quick follow-up, if I may.
Yes, and then Representative Smith and then Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess the point I'm trying to make, and it should be fairly obvious, is I agree with Senator Whitsitt. We don't want to spend money unnecessarily, but this strikes me as a relatively small one. But I have to venture to guess that it costs us more than $100,000 a year in duplicated services to do all these background checks on people like me, who's had three, as I mentioned, in the past 6 months, all through state agencies. So I understand Senator Whitsitt's point, and I appreciate it. I would just encourage us to think about the long-term potential savings with a relatively small upfront investment if we're starting to be concerned about the fiscal on this.
Thank you for your comment. Representative Smith.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. My comments overlap with Senator Steiner Hayward's. I get some sticker shock, but not prohibitive. My hunch is some of the savings are hard to calculate, and some of the savings aren't ours, right? But so you don't have to do three, you get to do one, and that has significant benefit to the world, even if it doesn't show up on our balance sheet. And then I will defer to the pleasure of the chairs about how we want to do this, but it has occurred to me for a while that it's a tricky thing. So we can't apply pressure and ask you for a zero fiscal or a lower fiscal. And then you have two choices. You can do less, or you can try to do more with the staff you already have. My hunch is that's the same decision we have to make if we pass this with a fiscal, where we then have to decide, do we want to ask you to do more with the same level of staff or do less and prioritize this over something else? And which political thing is easier or harder, I suppose I don't care that much, right? I mean, whether we put it on to you or whether we do it, but as long as we're eyes wide open that we are spending human time that we have to pay for, and as long as we are clear that I would also join Senator Johnson in asking you to, this seems like a priority, and without knowing your entire operation, I would probably prioritize this above something that might already be happening, and I'm not, and this doesn't have attached with it a tax, so I'm curious also about what we might cut. But with that said, don't want to send a signal every time that if anything shows a cost, we can't do it, because I'm not sure that's the best way for us to make decisions.
Senator Johnson.
I would just add my sense that there is some urgency around getting this resolved. Oregonians are calling out for this kind of common sense solution, but we have a hiring freeze right now. And you, sir, are presiding over the hiring freeze, I think, at the direction of the governor. So I'm trying to reconcile how can you ask for an LD at a limited duration position at $102,000 when you're the architect of the hiring freeze.
Madam Co-Chair, Senator Johnson, it's difficult. if I may, Madam Co-Chair, I'm not trying to be evasive with the committee. This is my first time through this at this kind of level, but I'm assuming this tension about cost of things. And to be honest, while this is an important issue for Oregonians and has the potential, I believe, without having done any analysis, if you can define us as all Oregonians, the cost savings will be many zeros and many commas. So it's certainly a prudent investment if we can be successful. I'm not aware if this has been tried in the past, so to think about consolidation of these systems or somehow streamlining this process. I realize there are also privacy issues involved and permanency of records issues and all kinds of things embedded in this discussion. The tension about cost is one we will just have to face, I think, forever. Is it a marginal cost? Is it a sunk cost? How can we accommodate the cost? The cost to do this work is real. It does not happen for nothing. Now, how we accommodate the cost, how we deal with it as an institution, that's the question. The fiscal, I'm sure, was to articulate that there's a cost to do this work. Due respect to my boss, I would probably find a way to find the human resource somewhere in state government to reassign it to actually be able to do this committee work and bring a report. Obviously, huge amounts of work after that if we actually want to implement some kind of new system. This is the tip of the iceberg regarding the analysis. So,
Madam Chair, could I ask for just a brief recess for a consultation among the chairs?
Sure. Yes.
Thank you.
We're in recess briefly. We're out of recess. We are still in work session on House Bill 4091, and I think I heard Senator Johnson asking for recognition.
Madam Chair, I would be prepared to make a motion with respect to House Bill 4091, and I'd like if you would give me the leave to make a couple of editorial comments. I think in recognition of the fact that this is Mr. Jordan's first session, he may not have had ample opportunity to review the fiscal and the ramifications, and so I think that we would risk losing a very good bill if we don't act today on these very short timelines. So I am going to move HB 4091 to the full Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation, but also with the hope that we could refine the fiscal between now and, I presume, full will meet on Friday, between now and the time of full, and see if we can figure out how to do this with a de minimis fiscal rather than $102,000. I want to recognize Mr. Jordan's efforts in trying to streamline DAS, and I think that this may just be his first walk through how a fiscal works in this kind of a setting. And so with that, that's my motion. We've heard from LFO about the fiscal, and my motion would include having it go with this fiscal, but with the request that it be refined before it makes it to full.
Is there discussion on the motion? Senator Whitson.
I'm going to support this motion today, but very likely will not support the motion in full unless this fiscal is considerably reduced to something more reasonable. I find it quite excessive at this point. I'll leave it at that.
Thank you for your comments. Additional discussion. Are there objections to the motion? Seeing no objections, the motion passes. Carrier?
I'd like to volunteer you.
Okay. I'll carry, and now I'm going to close the work session. Closing the work session on House Bill 4091, and we are resuming the public hearing on Senate Bill 1587 relating to property appraisal. And we still had a couple of names on the witness list for that bill. We have more than two, actually. I believe the first name is Robert M. Green. Did I get that right? And Brian Glanville. And that will be followed by Bob Keith and Diane Forsberg, I believe.
That's terrible.
Yeah, it was.
Just remember to begin with your name for the record.
Co-chairs Nathanson, Garrard, and Johnson, and members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Robert M. Green. I am addressing the committee both as an appraiser in the state of Oregon and as the president of the Greater Oregon Chapter of the Appraisal Institute. The Appraisal Institute is the preeminent professional organization for real estate appraisers in the United States.
Thank you.
It has nearly 24,000 members. It is the largest body of real estate appraisers in the country. And it is truly a professional organization. That is, it is concerned with the standards, the reliability, the professionalism, and independence of the profession. We are interested, of course, in our own welfare, but beyond that, we have committed ourselves to the highest standards of excellence and public service. It is an article of faith for us that we are best served when the greater good of the public is served. The Greater Oregon Chapter has 481 members. It is the largest such group in our state, and its goals mirror the goals of the Appraisal Institute in general. Representatives of other appraisal organizations are here as well. I have been asked by the officers, the members of the Board of Directors, and members of the chapter to speak in opposition to Senate Bill 1587. I fully agree with the chapter's opposition to this bill. There are three primary reasons. The first is that the current semi-independent appraiser certification licensing board has been recognized by the National Appraisal Subcommittee as a model for good governance and supervision of the uniform standards for professional appraisal practice. The Appraisal Subcommittee is the overarching national committee for appraisal standards. Its mission is to maintain the integrity of valuation standards for federally related transactions, including mortgages by federally chartered lending institutions. It is relevant to note here that the current status of this board arose partially out of a negative report by that same appraisal subcommittee in 2001, in which the ACLB in its prior status could not keep up with enforcement. If that issue had not been successfully addressed, which included creation of the current status, federal lending in the state of Oregon might have been jeopardized. No mortgage lending, period. Mr. Glanville is going to speak in a minute more directly to that issue. Secondly, real estate valuation is a complex profession that has implications for virtually everyone in Oregon. The public is better served by a semi-independent body that has the experience, the specialized knowledge, and the dedication to master the field. Moreover, this particular moment when real estate has been buffeted by a host of fundamental economic and financial forces is a poor time to jeopardize a well-regarded regulatory body. Finally, the majority of our members are in favor of the current semi-independent status of the ACLB. I do not believe that everyone is entirely happy with everything about the board, but there are no complaints of which I am aware that cannot be addressed under the current status, and we are confident that they will be. A proposed change will make the regulatory process less responsive, not more. As a coda, I note that a series of amendments has been proposed, although the amendments appear to be a complete rewrite and an utterly different proposal. They were not presented when this bill was introduced to the Government Services Committee, where I and several other people also testified. The so-called Dash 1 amendments to the original bill seem to concern three areas, which I will briefly address. The first is barriers to entry. You should know that the qualifications for real estate appraisers licensed to appraise for federally related transactions, which includes virtually all properties for which mortgage financing is necessary, is not set by the state. It is under the umbrella of the appraisal subcommittee, a federal body. The Oregon ACLB's mandate is to enforce those universal requirements. The state cannot reduce those requirements without jeopardizing appraisal for federally related transactions in Oregon. The second issue is conflict of interest. I am not personally aware, nor are any members of the board of our organization aware, of demonstrated conflicts of interest. We are aware, however, of a single charge of conflict of interest, which was reviewed and cleared to the satisfaction of the General Counsel Division of the Oregon Department of Justice. And finally, conflict resolution. To the best of my knowledge, the Dash 1 amendments do not provide a framework for dispute resolution superior to those mechanisms already in place, which also already includes, I believe, legislative oversight. In conclusion, I and the Greater Oregon Chapter of Real Estate Appraisers, along with our colleagues in the National Association of Independent Fee Appraisers, the American Society of Farm Managers and Rural Appraisers, and the National Association of Appraisers, all or most of which have representatives here today, urge you not to approve Senate Bill 1587, either in its original or in its amended form. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you.
Thank you. And I do have a question. The amendment seems to be, at least the one I'm reading, seems to be a pretty simple, straightforward request for information to just report, basically report a few things. Some of it is factual information and some of it is asking for a recommendation or an option about something. Is that the same amendment that you're expressing opposition to, a report?
Well, you know, the problem is we were originally presented with Senate Bill 1587. Mm-hmm. We came down to Salem. We testified on that. some the chairman of the Government Service Committee said they couldn't forward anything with amendments because it hadn't been presented to the committee. And this other series of amendments seems to strike out some things, seems to address some certain things. I think probably it would certainly require more study from us, but because of the genesis of it and because of the uncertainty of some of the language, we are concerned about it. We don't think that it provides for anything that is not already available. Insofar as it talks about requirements for entry into the profession, that is not something that can be addressed without jeopardizing licensing in the state of Oregon.
Okay, thank you. Representative Smith.
Whenever questions are appropriate.
If it's for this testimony, that's fine.
Yeah, thanks. So we heard testimony about the genesis of this bill came from a set of problems. And I do have a generalized concern that we make a generalized solution for a specific problem. Is there anything you can tell us about the circumstance or circumstances we heard about that would allow us, in plain language, that would help us have confidence that we could avoid such things in the absence of this bill?
I can't speak to those direct circumstances because everything I know about that is secondhand. Some of it I've heard here today. I will tell you that in my time here over the last couple of years, our chapter has had issues with two actions of the board. One of them had to do with reciprocity with adjoining states. The other one had to do was a fairly technical issue having to do with the status of draft reports. In both cases, in the case of reciprocity, the board was, after having already made a decision, listened to us and they responded to us. In the case of draft reports, they amended their original proposals in reference to our concerns. So, as I say, we have never been universally in agreement with everything that the ACLB has done, but we have found them to be reasonable and to listen to us, and we've been fairly satisfied with that. Does that answer your question, sir?
Maybe.
Okay.
I follow up, I'm sure. I mean, is it so? Do you have a sense, there could be two circumstances, at least. One, passage of this bill would prevent bad things from happening, but it's a big hassle and we shouldn't do it because it's a big hassle. Another option is there are other mechanisms to keep bad things from happening that already exist, and that was a bad thing that happened in a context of lots of things being done, and therefore this would not necessarily solve that problem, even if it made us feel like we had done something to address something that had happened.
I'm not even prepared to say that something bad was done, but I do have direct experience that when there is a dispute, there are mechanisms in place and that this would be superfluous or redundant.
Okay, thank you.
Please proceed.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, I'm Brian Glanville. I'm a certified real property appraiser in the state of Oregon and have been for over 34 years. In 1991, I served in Mr. Green's position as chapter president of the Appraisal Institute when a federal law was passed known as FIREA. That law required states who wanted to have federally related transactions to have a state licensure board and to follow the rules of the Appraisal Subcommittee of Congress in order to continue to have federally related transactions within that state. Obviously, that got the attention of the lending institutions in this state. They essentially wrote that bill and brought me in to try to tweak it enough to get the appraisers on board with it. At that time, we were placed under the Department of Consumer and Business Services. In 2001, when we switched to going to the semi-independent status, I was national president of the Appraisal Institute, working with government agencies, including the Appraisal Subcommittee, and I continue to do those today for other professional groups. What I've got in front of me and passed out to you are some letters from the Appraisal Subcommittee that I received this morning regarding the oversight of the Oregon Board. The first one is from 1997. Some of the information that I want to paraphrase. The board has a large number of open complaints dating from 1993, 94, and 95, which require expeditious resolution. At the time of our review, there were over 100 complaints which have been open for more than 2 years. Additionally, of the 219 complaints which have been closed, 52 were open for more than 2 years before they resolved. We also note the number of steps involved in the complaint process as evidenced in the January 24, 1997 letter to Representative Devlin's office and in information gathered during field review, etc. Farther down, they say, for this reason, the fact the board is not authorized to approve staffing levels, we are sending a copy of this letter to the Deputy Director, Department of Consumer and Business Services. They followed up in 2000, again, because of the problems with the state of Oregon. Although much of your program is effective, our review revealed there were weaknesses in Oregon's complaint investigation and resolution program. We have repeatedly expressed our concerns regarding these shortcomings during past reviews. Unless significant improvements are made in this program, we will be forced to address this matter with the governor of Oregon. It was pretty much a threat that they could shut us down from doing federally related transactions. They talked about, again, case had been backlogged consistently, an average of 2 years, 4 years, and again, nothing had really happened in the ensuing year. And they said they would follow up again, which they did in 2001, which was the time we started to go to the independent status. We are pleased to report, as of May 11, 2001, that Oregon is addressing our concerns. Of the 208 complaint cases open in July 2000, only 32 remain unresolved. We commend the board and staff for their efforts. In 2003, we are pleased to inform you that based on our review, your program functions effectively in a manner consistent with Title IX of the Financial Institutions Reform, Recovery, and Enforcement Act of 1989. The point being, we were under the DCBS before, and the state was not able to comply effectively with requirements of the federal government. By going independent, we were able to comply, and since then, we have complied. Every year there has been a review, and according to Denise Graves, Deputy Executive Director of the Appraisal Subcommittee, it's as good as it gets as far as the reviews for the state of Oregon. So we have met those compliances and kept the federally related functions moving forward. I do speak again the idea of doing away with the independent status. And as far as your questions, Representative Smith, I agree questions are fine. I guess my question as a native Oregonian is, why does the legislature need a bill to ask questions of a state agency on licensing? Ask the questions, get the answers, and get it fixed if there's a problem.
Thank you for your testimony, Senator Whitsitt. And I do want to point out that we are quite a bit over time from our usual adjournment time, and we have testimony from at least three more persons to hear during public hearing.
I do have a question, and each for either one of you. Do you believe it is appropriate for an appraisal certification and licensing board member to be assigned to review, and to be paid to review an appraisal over which the board has sanctioning authority?
I'll try that one. I personally think it was probably inappropriate, and my understanding is that was handled, and I don't think you're going to see that again. You'll have to ask more from the representatives of that board, but I think they've learned their lesson on that case. I wouldn't expect to see that again. And as far as the earlier question of past members of the board being asked to do reviews, who better that knows the standards and the rules of the state of Oregon to see if there's a problem? These people are like me, that they volunteer to serve. They are no longer part of the board, and they've been asked as appraisers to do a review. And they have to follow federal-related standards on what it has to be in that review, or they can be brought up on charges.
Now, the question was regarding a current member of the board, and
yes,
that seems to be a prima facie conflict of interest in my mind.
I agree with you. I don't think that was the appropriate action. I think they've
fixed that.
Senator Johnson?
Just an opinion question. Do you think a person could be qualified to be a county assessor if they had, as their experience, 5 years as a principal real estate broker licensed under ORS Chapter 696?
No.
One of the problems with the original law, again, the bankers wrote it because they wanted to get it done very quickly so that they were in compliance with the federal law. So they exempted assessors, brokers doing tax appeals, just about anybody who might fight the bill. Frankly, I do a lot of tax appeals against this state, and the assessors do not in this state follow the uniform standards of professional appraisal practice. Like most assessors throughout the country, it's a flaw in our law and one we need to fix.
Thank you.
I have a question for you.
Thank you for your testimony. We're going to, let's see, the three names I haven't checked off, Bob Keith, Joel Merwin, Diane Forsberg, that's our next testimony.
A quick question, Madam Chair. Do we remember that in the last session we moved the Board of Accountancy? Was that doing exactly the opposite thing of this bill? Was that taking it from the ambit of DCBS and moving it to the semi-independent status? Do you guys remember that bill?
The bill didn't pass. The Board of Accountancy is still a state agency.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Oh, okay. But we did. But it
bill,
was a similar question.
Was
or,
doing
you know,
the
converse question. All right. Thank you very much.
Whichever one of you wants to go first is fine.
Madam Chair and esteemed members of the committee, my name is Bob Keith. I'm the administrator for the Appraiser Certification Licensure Board, and I have been for about the last 10 years. Joining me to my left is the current board chair, Jill Merwin, and we'll both have a few comments for you. Consistent with the governor's directive for state agencies to not take a position on a bill, the appraiser board neither supports nor opposes this bill. And our appearance today is in order to present for you information that we think might be helpful to you in making a decision. Now, based on the manner in which the bill was referred over from the Senate committee over here, and based upon the possibility that you could not adopt the Dash 1 amendments and move the original bill, our comments will touch on briefly some of the policy issues as well as some of the fiscal issues. As previously mentioned, this bill does terminate the semi-independent status of the board, and it also requires certain oversight to be provided by the Department of Administrative Services and by the Emergency Board and the Legislative Assembly. According to a January 12, 2012 fiscal impact statement that was provided by the Legislative Fiscal Office, if this bill passes, it will result in an increase in the cost to do business for the board of approximately $70,800, which translates to about $47 per licensee for a two-year license cycle. Currently, the license fee for renewal for an appraiser is $250 per year. Now, when the board was created in 1991, the renewal fees at that time were $200, and there have been no fee increases except for January 1st, 2008, and those fees went up $50 per year. I might also mention at the time of the fee increase, there were 723 more appraisers than there were in the first biennium of the board's existence, which is a 74% increase in licensees. Section 3 of Senate Bill 1587 requires that the board adhere to Oregon Revised Statute Chapter 183 when it proposes to refuse to renew a license, to revoke or suspend a license. Representatives and senators, the board already does that, and it never takes such action without adhering to ORS 183. In Section 5 of this bill, it speaks to the issue of state personnel relations law. Only semi-independent agencies are not bound by that law. If there's a termination of semi-independent status, then naturally we would be bound by that law. And Section 6 requires fees that are established by the board not to exceed the cost of administering the regulatory program. The board already does that. As a matter of fact, the legislature gave us a gift on January 1st of this year, which was a new program to regulate for appraisal management companies, and we developed a separate budget, expenses and projected revenue just for that program in order to prevent the possibility of one group subsidizing the cost of the other group or vice versa, groups meaning appraisal management companies or appraisers. Section 9 of the bill requires the board to provide a financial statement to the Oregon Department of Administrative Services on or before September 30th of each year. The board already does that and has been doing that since its inception.
Excuse me, Representative Girard.
Excuse me, Madam Chair, just a point of question. The only thing we're dealing with at this point is the amended bill versus the bill. Am I correct, Bob?
Madam Chair, Nathanson, Representative Girard, I don't know. My understanding is that this bill could move forward without the Dash 1 amendments. And if that's not true, then, pretty much covered the original bill in my comments at this point. So I think we're ready to move on to the Dash 1 amendments.
Excuse me, just to clarify, the process is the bill passed out of committee, but without the Dash 1 amendment being added. And the Dash 1 is basically a big substitute for much of the bill.
Okay.
That had not been completed by the committee. So what our committee received is the original bill plus an amendment, and it would be this committee's choice to consider it the amendment and pass the amendment or not do anything at all. We have several options available to us, but please continue your testimony.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
At this time, I'd like to turn it over to our board chair, Jill Merwin, who has a few comments.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jill Merwin, and I live in rural Benton County. I'm a certified residential appraiser in the state of Oregon, and I've been a professional appraiser for 32 years. Also, I have served as a volunteer board member on the Oregon Appraiser Certification and Licensure Board for the last 8 years, and for the last 2 years as board chair. I am proud of my service to the citizens of Oregon and of all that the board has accomplished during this time. The board neither supports nor opposes Senate Bill 1587, nor the Dash 1 amendments to that bill. My testimony today is in addition to written testimony from the board that was provided to each of you via email on Friday, February 17th. In my opinion, the Dash 1 amendments reflect a lack of understanding about several key issues. My testimony today is intended to provide the committee with information that the board believes is necessary for you to make an informed decision. The Dash 1 amendments call for the board to identify barriers to entry into the appraisal profession and to make recommendations to ease those barriers. The board recognizes that barriers do indeed exist in the form of minimum qualification criteria, but they are in place as part of a federal mandate for public protection. Appraisers are in the business of giving their opinion of value. Therefore, it is essential that anyone calling themselves an appraiser has demonstrated a minimum level of education and experience, and that they have successfully passed a national appraiser examination demonstrating minimum competency in appraisal theory and practice. Congress has charged an independent entity known as the Appraiser Qualifications Board with the responsibility of establishing minimum qualification criteria to become a licensed or certified appraiser. These criteria are mandatory for all state appraiser regulatory agencies. The board has adopted these minimum criteria by rule and unfortunately has no authority to adopt lesser qualification criteria. The board has not imposed criteria that exceed the nationally required minimums. Testimony during a public hearing by proponents of Senate Bill 1587 reflected concern about a perceived conflict of interest between board members for their respective roles in the failed state acquisition of a large tract of land with a trout hatchery in southern Oregon. A senior assistant attorney general with the Department of Justice addressed this issue in a February 14, 2012 memorandum stating that no conflict or potential conflict of interest existed because both board members were acting outside their capacity as board members. A copy of this memorandum has been provided to you with the written testimony that I previously referenced. I have asked Board Administrator Bob Keith to address Dash 1 language regarding dispute resolution and legislative oversight of the Appraiser Certification and Licensure Board. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today.
Thank you. And we have another person, Diane Forsberg.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. Yes.
A couple other comments about dispute resolution.
It's going to have to be very quick.
Right. It's not clear what the legislators mean by this. Is it dispute resolution between appraiser and client for valuation purposes? Is it between the appraiser and an appraiser that's being between the appraiser board and someone who's being investigated? Because we already have the process in place through the Administrators Procedures Act and the Attorney General model rules for contested cases for appraisers to disagree with the board in pursuit of that type of an action. The other thing that's really relevant that I want you to understand when it comes to accountability of this agency and any other state licensing board is that we already have, through some independent statute, ORS 182, the requirement for, and this is the report that we submitted, the last one for 2009, these reports for all semi-independent agencies require that we provide the governor, the Senate president, the Speaker of the House, and the legislative fiscal officer with information regarding our budget, our financial audits, which are required every 2 years, that go to the Secretary of State, a description of the rules, temporary and permanent, that we adopt, as well as the activities the board has been involved with in terms of promoting consumer protection. It deals with the number and types of licensees, licenses that are issued, the processing time, the number of types of examinations, of investigations, sanctions. There's a lot of detailed information that goes into this report, which is given to Legislative Fiscal Office, who takes all the semi-independent reports and they boil them down into a single report. And this is that report right here. It goes to the Legislative Joint Audit Committee, as well as to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. This is a pretty comprehensive report. It gives the legislature the opportunity to take a look in to operations of the board. Now, what happens to those reports once they reach the public officials that they're designated to go to and how they're distributed amongst the members of the Legislative Assembly, I don't know. But we've been making these reports every 2 years since 2001. I also might mention that the board has not received a single piece of feedback from anybody about the operations of the board in conjunction with these things that I had indicated that we have to report about. On the issue of the conflict of interest, there is a memo that has been provided to you as part of the board's written testimony. It has been prepared by the Department of Justice, a senior assistant attorney general, and it says that there was no conflict of interest.
Madam Chair, I'm not sure we've been provided that. Madam Chair, some of us are already blowing through other appointments, and I'm wondering how many more people are on the witness list. And
one more.
Okay.
The information that I sent to each of you by email, which I think Patty O'Reilly is passing out to you now, contains that legal memorandum. I also would like to point out to you that when this was first brought to the board's attention, which was in April of 2009 in a meeting with Senator Winter's office, the board took swift action when they adopted a resolution, or actually a policy. And the policy simply says, and I can provide copies of this to you as well, policy says, when one board member of the Oregon Appraiser Certification Licensure Board is engaged for a review appraisal assignment by another board member, the board member relationship must be disclosed to the client and any intended users of the review assignment prior to the acceptance of that assignment.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Keith, we do have one other person who wants to testify.
And I understand the disclosure, but so what? What if somebody objects? Do you have a policy that says if there's an objection, it doesn't move forward?
Exactly. And you hit the nail right on the head. That's the purpose for the disclosure, is that the disclosure is made to the client. The client gets to decide, whoa, wait a minute. Oh, we don't want this type of relationship in this appraisal, so we're not going to do it. The client gets to choose. Okay. The conflict of interest that... the perceived conflict of interest that exists simply isn't around anymore because both board members are gone. Now, this is not a pattern. This is the only time that anything like this has happened in the 11 years that I've been employed by the board.
Madam Chair, I just don't see anything here in writing that says that there's a process to disqualify the review.
I'm just not sure that I understand your question.
Well, they have to disclose that in the review assignment, but it doesn't say that there can be an objection that then disqualifies the review appraisal. It just says you have to disclose.
Disclose to the client and any intended user prior to acceptance of the assignment. So if the client or an intended user has a problem with it, then the assignment is in place.
Okay.
Senator Whitsitt.
Why would you have a member of your board make the review? That sets you up to from my perspective, that was the genesis of the problem in the first place, and now you're going to do the same thing again, only you're just going to say, well, somebody had a chance to object. You still have that same, and it appears to me, that same inherent conflict of interest.
Madam Chair and Senator Whitsitt, thank you for that. I think what we have here is a fundamental misunderstanding of how things work. I believe that the committee may have been given information which has caused them to believe that things work a certain way when they don't work that way. And specifically with respect to the review, it's unfortunate that you weren't able to review the information that I sent to you because it's kind of outlined in there. In a fairly concise form, but I can lay out the entire scenario for you, but I don't think you have time to do that, Madam Chair.
That's right. We don't even have time for the last piece of testimony. Committee, are you willing to stay another few minutes? Mr. Keith doesn't seem to be finished. Are you completed with your testimony, or can you be?
I'm really interested in fielding more questions about this this conflict. The board did not hire one of its own appraisers to make a review. That's not what happened here. The review was conducted by a board member. Another board member serving on the board worked for Parks and Rec, and in the process of doing his job as an acquisition specialist, he engaged as a private appraiser another board member. Okay. That's not a conflict of interest according to the Department of Justice.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
You know, it's great to hide behind the conflict of interest and the opinion of the DOJ, but to the normal person observing that, it's outrageous.
Well, that's why those two board members aren't board members any longer, and that's why the board adopted a policy, which, by the way, was at the suggestion of Senator Winters, and she was provided a copy with this policy prior to it even being adopted by the board, and she was satisfied with it.
I guess that just begs the question, if she was satisfied with it, why is she back with this bill?
Madam Chair and Senator Johnson, that is a good question.
Okay.
Yeah, and I'll be happy to talk to you about that in private maybe, but not in...
Madam Chair, as a courtesy to whoever the final testifier is, maybe we could hear from them.
I would like to do that now. Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
And was there anyone else in the audience who hadn't signed up but wants to testify?
Thank God, no.
Okay.
Madam Chair, in the interest of time, my testimony is...
You'll need to say it in front of a microphone just because this gets recorded. Thank you.
Yes, Madam Chair, in the interest of time, my testimony is basically what everybody else has said, so I'll just not testify. Would that be okay?
Madam Chair, I'd like clarification. Do you support the bill or do you oppose the bill?
My name is Diane Forsberg. I'm a real estate appraiser, and yes, I support. I absolutely oppose 1587 and 1587-1.
Thank you.
And thank you for your comment. I appreciate your willingness to just say ditto. Okay, committee, we're going to have a recess just for maybe 60 seconds to do a time check. We're in recess.
Yes, thank you. Madam Chair, given that we have gotten two very lengthy opinions that appear to have comments from the DOJ in them, and some of us did not have an opportunity to review some of this material ahead of time, I don't feel prepared to amend or move the bill at this point in time. I'd like a chance to review the voluminous material that we've been given today.
Thank you.
Ms. Toe, could you please describe for us what the process is for holding this over and when we might be able to consider this again?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the next meeting is Thursday, so we can carry the bill over to Thursday.
That's my intent. So if that's the intent, I can still close the work session, or are we just it's officially closing the work session and we can reopen a work session? All right. Thank you. At this, oh, no, this is the public hearing.
We've only had public hearing.
We're still in public hearing. I'm going to close the public hearing. We have not opened a work session, and we're not going to open a work session today. The committee is not ready to consider amendments and bills today related to this topic. So there's no other work before us today, and we will post a work session if there's going to be a work session on this. Anything else for the good of the board of this committee? We're adjourned. Committee, we're adjourned.